Penguin Random House Audio presents The Eagle's Claw, a novel of the Battle of Midway, by Jeff Shara. Read for you by Paul Michael. This book is dedicated to George Lauer. Sometimes the greatest wisdom and insight stands right in front of you. To the listener. One of the challenges I've discovered in writing this story is that, unlike so many other campaigns in so many wars, the most significant events of the Battle of Midway take place within a single day, June 4, 1942. Thus, you may notice that the date and time that start each chapter might not be in perfect chronological order, one chapter taking place at the same time as, or slightly before, the one after. That might sound confusing, but I feel it actually works. You have to know what each side or each character is doing at any given moment, because in this story, many of those moments are some of the most dramatic and important in our history. Midway is a place that is quite simple geographically. A wide lagoon surrounded by a narrow coral reef that embraces two small islands, little more than hilly sandbars. That such a place should have such a role in the history of World War II defies logic. But that is the story. I hear frequently from readers who wonder why I chose to include a certain historical character or the details of some particular event. I'm sure it will be that way here. For me, it's another challenge always. What to leave out? Tens of thousands of sailors and Marines on both sides participated in this fight, and choosing the voices for this story was difficult. It is a story told through the points of view of perhaps more characters than I've included in the past, so that I could cover as many of the details as possible without muddying the narrative. I hope I'm right. That judgment will be yours. I won't describe each character here, since each is introduced as the story moves along. There are five principal voices on the American side, from admirals to pilots to gunnery sergeants and a codebreaker, who alone changes history. On the Japanese side, there are three admirals, very different men who play very different roles. And they, too, are responsible for changing history. I mentioned in my previous book, To Wake the Giant, that I am aware of the proper usage for Japanese names, last, first. For clarity's sake, and to stay consistent with English usage, I have used the names as we would, first, last. I expected considerable grief from Japanese readers for this, but their tolerance thus far has been most appreciated. So many on both sides who were a part of the Battle of Midway, whose heroism and sacrifice determined how this story would play out, deserve to be remembered. This is my offering. As I have said many times about my books, this is not a history book. But I hope that you will learn something you might not have known, as I certainly did. But even better, I hope that you will find these characters and this extraordinary event to be a good story. Midway changes the entire war, and so it changes history. In some ways, it changed me as I wrote it. I hope you enjoy this book. Jeff Shara, April 2021. Introduction. In early 1942, the American Navy is still reeling from the impact of the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. In Washington, D.C., and in many American newspapers, there are dramatic calls demanding revenge. These cries are loud and strident, the Japanese becoming a far more despised enemy than the Germans. Some of this stems from pure racism. The Germans, after all, look like us. Fueled by the news media as well as Hollywood's portrayals, the Japanese are depicted as a vicious alien race, and so for most Americans it is easy to accept them as the most evil enemy we face. After nearly a decade of brutal conquest and atrocities in China, the Japanese do very little to blunt that image. However, the regrettable result of this will be the establishment of internment camps, mostly in California, but also spreading elsewhere, where American citizens of Japanese descent are herded together, imprisoned behind barbed wire to protect the rest of the country from their predicted treachery. For the American military, particularly the Navy, the power of these official and public calls for action against the Japanese causes a problem. Prior to December 7, 1941, most Americans believed with certainty that the Americans simply can't be defeated in any war, against any opposition. At Pearl Harbor, that perception changes. America's defeat there is absolute. The result, of course, is a movement within the military to find an effective way to strike back. But the admirals know they are outgunned, and that any large-scale assault on Japanese forces is simply foolish. Under pressure from Washington, American ships and planes engage in minor battles throughout the South Pacific, but the results are meager at best. In early January 1942, American submarines sink three Japanese freighters near the coast of Japan. The event is a brief morale boost for the Navy, though it has no effect at all on Japanese military planning. To emphasize that point, less than a week later, a Japanese submarine torpedoes the carrier USS Saratoga, barely 500 miles from Hawaii. Though the carrier survives, it is put out of action for several months. Throughout the winter and early spring of 1942, the American Navy engages in hit-and-run raids on Japanese ships and island bases, some of which are moderately successful, none of which will change the course of the war. Throughout these engagements, the Japanese give as good as they get, sinking a number of American warships along the way. The most costly fight comes at the Battle of the Java Sea near present-day Indonesia, when the Americans lose three destroyers and three cruisers without sinking a Japanese ship. The Japanese are arrogantly aware of their dominance of the seas, and as part of the expansion of their Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, plans are made to strike directly at Australia, or at the very least, to sever supply and communication lines between that country and the United States. In addition, moves are made that result in driving the once mighty British Navy completely out of the region at considerable loss. The Japanese Navy is spearheaded by the ships of their Kido Butai, Mobile Force, commanded by Admiral Chuichi Nagumo, a sullen and disagreeable man who had commanded the same fleet during its assault on Pearl Harbor. The Kido Butai consists of most of Japan's larger aircraft carriers, plus a significant number of supporting ships, far outmuscling their American counterparts. The Japanese rely on air power and speed, and they operate with plenty of both. For several months, the Japanese people are told, and the emperor and his military believe, that they are utterly invincible. Later, this belief becomes known by Japanese historians as their victory disease, the concept that no matter your planning or your actions, you will defeat your enemy simply because you always have. That comforting philosophy does not sit well with men like Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, commander of Japan's combined fleet, and others around him who are charged with planning and executing Japan's next moves. In spring 1942, two events create a flow toward what will follow. On April 18th, 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers, under the command of Colonel Jimmy Doolittle, launch from the carrier USS Hornet. Their one-way mission is to drop bombs on Tokyo and other Japanese cities. There is no great strategic goal intended, the raid serving as more of a symbolic move. but it sends a message to the Japanese that America had a claw that could reach them. And
sample complete. Ready to continue?